This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week, we come to you from Amman, Jordan. In the interest of full disclosure, I have to talk about my next guest with a little bit of background. I've known him for more than 20 years. I've been coming to Jordan for more than 20 years, and when I first came here, I was doing a piece for the Travel Channel, and we had a pretty big crew here, and I needed a helicopter, I needed help, I needed guidance, and he gave it. We became very good friends. He then was the Minister of Tourism. He then went on to basically develop Aqaba as a major business center, not just a vacation destination. He's an advisor to His Majesty, the King of Jordan, and he now has the distinction of being the mayor of Amman. My good friend, His Excellency Akil Bultaji, welcome, sir.
Thank you, Peter, and welcome back home. It's home.
It is for me. That's the other interest of full disclosure. I do feel home here, and what's crazy about it is, and it brings up our first topic. And you know, so many of my friends, people who I believe to be educated, cultured, smart, traveled, they're always asking me, because they always can ask me this question, where are you going? Where are you coming back from? Whenever I tell them that, they go, really? It's safe? And, you know, there's a great fear factor about this region. I understand why. You understand why. And yet, when I drag my friends, and you know I've done this before, I drag them kicking and screaming to Jordan using a large strength, and you know, industrial strength spatula. I get them on the plane. I get them here. Within 24 hours, they're having a great time because they couldn't believe it was so great. But it's perception. This is a perception-based industry, travel. And the perception right now is the entire region is unstable.
It reminds me when you were here in year 2000 and Secretary Baker and his family, entire family, were here on a friends meeting. And they were downtown. And the people back home said, Baker in Amman at this time? And the answer was, if Peter Greenberg is in Amman, why not? So you are a sign of not only goodwill, but a good destination, a safe destination, because I think that's exactly what you do, and that's what you provide for your audience
although
and listeners.
Although I will tell you this, my job is really not to promote travel. My job is not to advertise or sell it. It's to present it, to let people know they can have... they can make intelligent choices about where they want to go and what they want to do. So I'm not out there flying a flag or cheerleading. I'm just letting them know that, yeah, it's okay to come. By the same token, Jordan has its share of problems, not many of its own, of its own doing. I mean, the fourth largest city you have right now is Syrian refugees.
Yeah.
You know, let's take a look at where you are geopolitically. You know, you're in a pretty tough neighborhood.
Well, this is a safe haven, has been, throughout the years, throughout the centuries. If you go through our history, you will find that people have always come to this part of the world, this part of the Holy Land, for refuge, particularly lately, in the last 100 years, you know, the creation of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, a princedom, and back in the last century, the 1923 on. But later on, in 48, accommodating a lot of the Palestinians, and then in the year 1990 on, a lot of Iraqis, 1.5 million at one point. And prior to that, when Saddam Hussein barged into Kuwait, 500,000 Jordanians fled back home. So that was another kind of wave of emigration. Then on and on, and now the Syrian refugees and finding Jordan not as just a neighbor, but a brotherly country, and our arms and homes are open for them. It has created issues, problems, impact, and I'm glad that the world community is getting more and more aware of this, Peter. And you will throughout, you know, your stay here, and you'll see that you will probably hear a Syrian accent here, an Iraqi accent there, a Yemeni, a Libyan, even, plus the Egyptians who make a good number of people, but they're workers here.
I mean, to put things in perspective, not until recently, I remember Gulf War I landing in Amman and seeing on the runway all the old Iraqi air jets that were flown here, and everybody just got off the plane and ran.
And
those planes stayed on that runway out there at the airport for years.
Yeah. And you kept on reminding us.
I did.
Why don't they fly?
No, why don't you just get rid of them? I mean, they were the old 727.
Well, they were getting rid of sold scrap. Yeah. So that's how it was.
And by the way, you have a new airport within the last 3 years. I mean, that's a big change, too.
A great airport. And it's a PPP. It's a private-public partnership project. It has proven to be right. The government is making money. The passengers and customers are getting a much, much better service. The investors are also making money, and that's free enterprise.
Plus your airline, Royal Jordanian. When I first flew Royal Jordanian, they had a couple of old Airbuses. They had Lockheed L-1011s. They had the TriStars. Now you've got, you did.
Come on. Were from Burbanks, Peter.
From Lockheed and Burbank, right.
Yeah, they were the best in the sky in those days. Remember
King Hussein used to fly that 1011.
Yeah, remember the cockpit?
Yeah.
That cockpit was close to...
that was luxurious. It was a suite.
Right, yeah.
Oh, my God.
But again, Royal Jordanian is still flying, and now the Dreamliner, the 787, and I hope you took that from
I did, yeah. A great flight. But the bottom line is, your numbers are still down. And I'm one of those people who says the following, that the best time to go to a destination, with exceedingly few exceptions, is either after a natural disaster, a civil disturbance, or an act of political terrorism or violence. Because that's when they need to see you the most. That's when they are most open to welcome you. You'll have the best service. You'll have the best experience. And you won't spend a lot of money. Jordan, for me, has been that way for 20 years.
You know, Peter, at one point you told me what your mother taught you or told you, to stay interested and not interesting. You know, if people are interested in a destination, they'll find a way. They'll find an excuse. They'll come out and help. We want people to be interested in this part of the world, to learn more about it. Like you have done years and years over and again. And so maybe the numbers then are down. But this is a chance for us to reach out and seek and say, folks, come and see what we're going through. See how we can accommodate people in distress. And also to our American friends, see where your income tax money is spent. Because a lot of it is spent on schools, on hospitals.
That's USAID.
Or USAID. And we're proud of that. So come and be interested in what you do overseas to people who are in need and in distress. And people who have kept the word to fight terror, no matter where it is, from day one, 9/11, was the alert that we joined forces.
Toto? Feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
In the interest of full disclosure, this is one of those shows where almost every guest I have to say, in the interest of full disclosure, I know this guy. We've hung out together for a number of years. He has probably one of the better jobs in the world. Well, he does. He's the director of the Royal Automobile Museum, among many other things. His name, Raja Garg. Hello, Raja.
Hello, how are you, Peter? Nice seeing you again.
You know, when you come to this part of the world, in all candor, you don't necessarily think of a Royal Automobile Museum, and yet you've got a good one.
We have a very nice one. In fact, King Hussein, the late Majesty King Hussein, used to be a great car buff, and he started practically racing in Jordan since the mid-50s.
Road rallies,
hill climbs, speed tests. He started single-handedly all the rallying and racing in Jordan, and we now reach the World Rally Championship as an international venue. So it all started in the mid-50s.
Well, I remember the current king, King Abdullah II, when he was prince, he was doing all the road rallies too.
He sure was. He won the championship in 86 and 88.
So what's in the museum? Because if you take a look at a car museum in the United States, you know, we have certain museums like at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. They have all the Air Force Ones. There are other museums that have all the presidential limos, all the cars that took the presidents. I'm sure you have that too.
Well, we have there are an automobile museum. Basically, shows all the cars that saw the events that happened in Jordan since the 20s and 30s. While most of it is King Hussein's, of course, the automotive history and the history of Jordan are parallel since the early 1900s. So the first car, for example, the first car that was seen around was the armored Rolls-Royce of the Great Arab Revolt. So we start the museum with the Great Arab Revolt.
That must be one heavy car.
It is quite a heavy car. It's an armored Rolls-Royce replica.
It's a tank that has gold plating.
Yeah, just about. And you can't see out of it. And from there on, we have 100 years of the automotive history, which also parallels the history of Jordan and the progress we had in Jordan in the last 100 years.
I got to go back to the armor-plated Rolls-Royce.
Sure.
What year is that?
It's 1916.
Wow. Did they even know about armor plating back then?
Well, the British War Office started armoring these Rolls-Royces for World War I, and a few of these cars ended up in Jordan with the British forces.
They drove them to Jordan.
They were in Egypt, yes, headquartered in Egypt, and they joined in the Great Arab Revolt. As you've seen from Lawrence of Arabia, the movie, these cars were seen running around the desert in Wadi Rum.
I'm just trying to imagine a Rolls-Royce running around in the desert on those kinds of roads.
Yeah. The Silver Ghosts were the best cars ever made at that era. So the British War Office thought that they are the best chassis to put armored bodies on.
And they
produced them till 1924, so they had a bunch of them around.
And then, of course, when they weren't looking one day, whoops, one arrived in Jordan.
Yep.
It just showed up.
Yeah.
And now it's in the museum.
And now it's at the museum. And we're doing replicas, so we use them for heritage events and, for shows.
What's the most surprising item in your collection?
A recent arrival, to be honest. The collection is not about expensive cars, but the collection is about events and history. So we actually found, just a couple of months ago, the first car that King Hussein ever owned, a 1952 Rover, a small, measly...
A little British car.
A little British car of no automotive...
Where did you find it?
There is a guy who owned it.
Who owned
it in England, who knew someone...
Who knew somebody else.
Who knew us, so they called and said, I have King Hussein's first ever car. And we checked it, and lo and behold, it is. And it is
what kind
also.
What kind of condition was it in?
It was restored. It was in excellent condition. And in his book, Uneasy Lies the Head, he refers to the car. So we got it. So that's the first car that King Hussein ever had. And we also have the last car he ever ridden in, which is the 600 Pullman, the Mercedes, which everyone in Jordan practically stood in line on the sidewalks and to see him come in when he was very, very sick and a few weeks before he passed away.
But that was a car he also drove.
He used to drive that car on many occasions.
We're talking to Raja Garg of the Royal Automobile Museum.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
Joining me now, I'm honored to have with us Her Excellency Lena Anab, who's the Minister of Tourism of Jordan. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you come from the private sector.
I do.
So you come from a history of being in the hotel business. I know that.
Correct.
You've seen the ups and downs.
Absolutely.
And many downs.
Uh-huh.
Right? So what is your biggest challenge? Because the good news is, I remember when I first came here, tourism was almost flatlined. Mm-hmm. So the only way you could go was up. It couldn't get any worse.
Yeah.
Now, things are better than they were when I first came here, mm-hmm. but they're not great. So what is your challenge as a minister of tourism? Because your job, of course, is to promote tourism, to sell Jordan to the world. My job is not that. My job is to just present where I happen to be, right?
Yeah.
But what's your biggest challenge?
Peter, our biggest challenge is really delivering the message that you just delivered, that life is normal here. Yes, we are in an area where there is turmoil. However, the turmoil is in the area, not in Jordan. And life in Jordan is normal, is even more than normal. It's fun. There's a lot to do in Jordan. There is it's not what people think. So the challenge really is to break the stereotypes that have been built about our country.
Give me a stereotype.
Fear, you said it. Yeah. People being afraid to come here and not knowing exactly why they are afraid, only to know that that life is even probably more normal than any country perceived as being very safe for many people. So I think our biggest challenge today is trying to deliver the message that Jordan is not only life is going on as business as usual, it's a lot of fun to be in Jordan. There are so many, as you say, hidden gems in Jordan. I tell you, it will be very difficult to name the activities that one can do in Jordan because of the diversity of the product that we have. People think of us as desert, and yes, we are a desert. We have a beautiful desert.
You know, when I came here with His Majesty and we did our special on the Royal Tour, he took me whitewater rafting
exactly.
in Jordan. Who knew about Maji Mujib?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we have canyons in Jordan, we have caving in Jordan, we have forests in Jordan, we have a trail, we have a national trail, a 650 kilometer long that stretches from the northernmost of the country to the south, and it's as good as the best trails in the world. We really within a very short span of space, one can experience 8 biospheres. Imagine. There is so much to do. It's just incredible that people have not really caught on to the amount of fun that they are missing out.
What you mentioned earlier, I caught on to it. It reminds me of the political campaign in America now, that there's a great segment of the population that's angry but can't tell you why. And when it comes to travel, there's a great segment of the population that is fearful, but they can't tell you why.
Absolutely. I think this is the impact of the media. And if we are to talk about challenges or about what we need to do, we probably need to go out in the media at the same and show people what is going on in Jordan. And that is a lot of entertainment, a lot of concerts, a lot of festivals, people hiking. I was just this weekend in Petra. I tell you, the amount of people I saw from India, from Spain, from France, Americans, people are coming. They are not coming in the numbers we'd like to see them, but I think today we have what you call the immersive travelers. They are geopolitically aware, they are culturally aware, they realize that
they want an authentic experience.
Absolutely, and they are educated. They understand if there's a problem in a neighboring country, it does not mean that the problems are in the country itself.
And by the way, you mentioned Petra. I've probably gone 30 times. How much have I actually seen? I've just scratched the surface.
Absolutely. Petra, you need at least 2 to 3 weeks to say that you have covered enough of Petra.
Although if you've not gone to Petra before, and for those of you who haven't seen it, you actually have. It's called Indiana Jones. It was the Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's the Treasury Building when you come down that gorge.
Yeah.
But I want to tell you that the best way to see it is don't go to bed, and at 4:30 in the morning, work it out to go down there in the dark
as you go down that gorge, as the sun is starting to come up and that light hits that building,
right.
It's nothing like that anywhere in the world.
Nowhere. Yeah. And you know, in Petra today, there are about 13 trails that have been developed. And each trail tells a story. And each trail has a historical and cultural significance. Those by themselves need at least 2 to 3 weeks to cover. So
nobody's going to really take 2 or 3 weeks. So come once, keep coming back.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the trails in Petra, it's from Petra to, as we call it, Dana, it was rated by National Geographic as one of the best 16 trails in the world. And that's in Petra. So it's waiting for people to come and explore it. And believe me, people who are not coming here are missing out on a lot of fun.
I think you've had some fun.
Oh, yeah, I'm having fun.
Lena Anab, the Minister of Tourism here in Jordan. Hey, thanks for coming. For coming back to the show.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
We're honored to have on the show Her Royal Highness Princess Aliyah, and I'm welcoming you to the show because one of the things that we were able to do yesterday was to visit you at your new sanctuary.
Yes.
And what people don't realize, and I mentioned this earlier in the show when we were talking to Aka Boltaji, is that as small a country as Jordan is, it's still sort of a conduit for theft of animals, smuggling of animals.
Yes.
And I know this was not what you woke up to do a couple of years ago, correct?
Correct.
Tell me how you started the foundation and what you're doing with the sanctuary.
Well, the foundation's a very long story, actually. We'd started, over the years, I've been trying to work in various groups that help in various ways. But I was trying to really focus on slaughterhouse reform. And then through a friend, an Australian animal activist friend, she suggested doing a foundation for animal welfare. And I said, there's so many things. And I sincerely believe that everything is linked. So, and having worked with various groups that work with specific targets, animals, children, whatever, often there are other issues you want to address that you can't if it's very specific. So we gave ourselves a very wide mandate, which is compassion and respect for all creation. And that
so that means you can adopt me.
might be more than I could deal with.
I think we'll need a bigger cage.
No, but I mean, as everything is very much linked, we wanted to be able to have the ability to respond in any aspect that was needed. And we were quickly noticed that the animal trade, the illegal animal trade, and wildlife especially, is as you say, Jordan is a conduit.
But isn't it interesting that most of the focus in the world is not here, it's in Africa?
Yes.
Because of poaching. And we just had the situation in Kenya where they burned all the tusks that were seized. And because there's such a market for it.
Yes.
And it still continues, either as an art piece or an aphrodisiac or a perceived aphrodisiac. Mm. And animals are getting slaughtered, I mean, every hour.
Yes, indeed.
Here it's not as much slaughtered as it's just stolen, right?
Stolen. I mean, the local ones get stolen. Your pets are always being stolen. It's a huge problem. But we are also on the trade route between smuggling from the east to the west and to the Gulf and people who want exotic pets, etc. So a lot of the ones from Africa do end up here.
And you learned that. You didn't know that at the beginning.
No, we didn't know that. We weren't aware at all. We knew that there were a few in zoos, and we weren't quite sure how they'd got in, because, again, it's not legal to import them. And specifically the local wildlife.
Wait, let me stop a second. Isn't that interesting? It's not legal to import them, and yet they're showing up in zoos.
Yes.
We have no idea how they got there, but here they are. Look at the lion.
I mean, a lot of times there'd be people smuggling them, as we discovered, soon after we set up the center, to try and be a solution, because when they're confiscated, there was nowhere to actually send these animals. So the authorities would confiscate them, but not know what to do with them.
And now they're housing them, but they don't know what they're doing.
Yes.
So the knock came on your door.
Yes, we tried to be a solution, and we had a very small, actually it was an old abandoned farm that we quickly turned around, actually with the help of the municipality, to receive some wild animals that were coming through the following week. We managed to house those.
But that was really a temporary solution.
Absolutely. And so then we were looking for a regional solution, in fact. There are sanctuaries in South Africa and in many other countries of the world, but they're all becoming full. So to be a solution for this region was really, we hoped, a good target. And we've actually, since we were able to set it up, even before we set up the large sanctuary, we've had calls from other countries in this area saying we have this and we have that and can you take it?
Well, speaking of other countries in the area, we were all witness to the terrible decimation of the zoo in Baghdad.
Yes.
Right? Which I don't think they've ever been able to fix.
No.
And most of those animals, sadly, didn't survive.
Yes, very likely.
I know. As we talked about earlier in the show, Jordan as a safe haven for so many refugees, now we have animal refugees.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So you took over this land. What did you do?
We were actually leased it sort of from the Ministry of Environment because it's also a very beautiful forest area which was being suffering from deforestation. So it's a protection of the forest and the natural habitat there, and then trying to make it into a sanctuary rather than a zoo for animals because it's not their natural home, possibly. I mean, lions don't actually, there aren't many in this region now. But to try and have them in much better circumstances so they're out, they're in nature. And it would actually be an education point, a tourism point. It's a very poor area also, so hopefully it'll encourage tourism, job opportunities for the people in the region. Education, it's quite close to the University of Science and Technology, which trains our vets also. So, and since we started this, we've been able to train a couple of vets, and they're the first Arab wildlife vets, I think, in the region, which is also
pretty good.
Yes.
We're talking with Her Royal Highness Princess Aliya bin Al Hussein. And the name of the sanctuary is?
Well, Al Ma'wa, which means the sanctuary in Arabic. The smaller initial one was called New Hope, after a lion cub that we rescued that we called Hope. So New Hope is where they're prepared and sort of rehabilitated, shall we say. The wildlife that is indigenous and fit to be released, we release. And the other ones we keep there or we send up to Al Ma'wa.
And you're still in the process of developing and building.
Yes.
When are you actually going to open?
We're hoping to open in the spring. We were hoping to open 2 years ago, but, you know, as with most projects and builders and so on, it takes a lot longer than one expected.
But you already have animals there.
We do indeed. Yes, we moved them last week.
Okay. Tell me who's in residence.
In residence is a pride of five lions. Two of them were we received as literally days old. The other three were older cubs, but also those were the result of smuggling. And two other lions which were evacuated from Gaza when the zoo there appealed to Four Paws to help them, Four Paws International to help them. They brought them here. And so those two have moved also to adult lions.
Now you even have a Syrian brown bear.
Syrian brown bear and two tigers, which also were caught smuggling as a result of smuggling.
Well, let's talk about the tigers, then I'll get back to the bear.
Yes.
Where are the tigers from?
The tigers.
When you think Jordan, you don't think tigers.
No. Again, there was some wealthy businessman wanted to build a house here and have them in his garden. You know,
you're serious.
They were being smuggled through. Yes. They came from Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
Those two.
Here's my stupid question. Jordan is a pretty small country.
Yes.
I think, having come here all these years, everybody sort of knows what everybody else is doing, right? How do you hide a tiger?
Well, these animals, they tend to put them in literally cat cages, you know, and give them to someone, and someone not very wealthy, possibly a student or someone, you know, here's $200, you know, can you just deliver this to so-and-so? And they don't necessarily even know what they've got with them. And so it's very much up to the people at the borders to be very vigilant and find them. We had four lion cubs that arrived in two tiny cat crates and really squashed, you know, and very upset and angry, obviously. It's amazing the way that people do find to smuggle these creatures.
You know, it's interesting. The laws are in this region, not just Jordan, have always fascinated me. For example, in Kuwait, it's illegal to import a satellite dish, but not illegal to have one.
Mm.
So as long as they don't catch you bringing it in, it just showed up and here it is.
Yes.
Same thing with the animals in a way.
Well, with the animals it is, but once they're there, it's quite difficult. Again, then there's the, well, if you're going to cordon off the zoo or the pet shop or whatever, the animals in the meantime will starve because it'll, you know, access is denied. And it's always very complicated to get around that. So when they're actually caught by the authorities and delivered to us, it's much easier. But of course, the poor guy who was the one carrying them in, probably not even knowing what he had, is usually the one who gets into trouble rather than the people behind it.
But there's also an educational learning experience here on your end, because how do you take care of a tiger? You need to know first of all, this is not their natural habitat, no. And yet this is where their sanctuary is going to be.
Yeah, it's been a huge learning curve, like I said, and when we first had them, we were just really honored to be on first name terms with these creatures. But as you say, you know, especially the big cats, when they're taken away too young from their parents, they do suffer enormously and they are compromised. So you have to give them special food, nutrition, and calcium, and we're still learning.
This is your captain speaking. There is absolutely no cause for alarm.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. Peter, you know, I'm a big fan of talking to the locals. I'm a big fan of finding American expats who actually know what they're talking about, who love the country in which they're living in. And my next guest qualifies under both categories. And in the interest of full disclosure, I actually consider her my surrogate mother in Jordan every time I come. She's done so much here. She moved here when she was 22. She's been an American expat for years. She's the author of children's books. She's been on the board of the Petra National Trust. I mean, if you want to know anything that's going on in Jordan, the person to talk to is Karen Asfour. How are you, Karen?
Fine, thank you, Peter.
How is it being an American expat in Jordan?
Well, I've been one for so long. You can do your math if you want to, but I've been here for 53 years, and I came when I was 22. So that kind of tells you how long I've been here. It's been a great ride. I came, and the country was small, and Amman was small, and it was quiet, and then I've seen it grow, and I've seen so many different things happen while I've been here. So,
well, you've seen the conflicts. You've seen the solutions or the possible solutions.
That's right.
You've seen the boundaries change. You've seen the borders been redirected, redrawn.
That's right.
Have you seen a lot of people displaced?
That's true. Yes, I have.
And you're still here.
I'm still here because it's my home. I've lived here for so long that it's where I've raised my children. I consider myself a Jordanian. I'm also American, but I have dual nationality, and Jordan is important to me. The politics here are important. The life is important. Everything about this country is important to me.
Well, you've heard me say earlier in the show that so many of my friends, when they hear I'm coming to Jordan, go, "Oh, be careful, be safe. Are you crazy?" I'm sure you hear the same thing from friends of yours in the States.
Yes, I do. And I have to tell you, this is a true thing. I have never, ever been afraid for myself in this country. I would not hesitate to walk down a street at 2:00 in the morning, and it would not occur to me that I should be afraid. I have had only positive experiences with the population, with the people here, and to me, it's as safe as any place I could possibly live.
And you're also the author of a few children's books.
Yes, I am. I've written 3 children's books. I wrote them in English, and then my husband transcribed them in Arabic. And they're all to do with the environment. I am a bit of a passionate about the litter issue in Jordan, and I'm very distressed about it. So I wrote 3 books that are giving messages to children, anti-litter messages to children. Hopefully they pass it on to their parents and to the population here so we can clean the country up.
And what are the names of the books?
I have Anza Al-Aziza Cleans Up Petra. I have Anza Al-Aziza Protects the Forest. And I have Anza Azizi and Her Zero Footprint Lesson. Anza means goat in Arabic, and Aziza means precious, so it's like a precious goat. And so she's giving lessons about how to clean up, keep your country clean.
Now, as someone who's been here since she was 22, you're the perfect person to ask this. Give me the place where you like to go to dinner that's not in the brochure, that's not in the guidebook, that is like your favorite place in Amman?
I have great favorite places in Amman, but I have a very favorite place that's down toward the toward Aqaba. I love Aqaba, but I love the Echo Lodge in Fanan, and that's one of my very favorite places that I like to go to.
And why?
And why? Because it is so special. They've tried to do everything there so environmentally green, and it's quiet, and it's an adventure to get there because the road is terrible, and you have to go in a four-wheel drive, and you jiggle yourself to death, but it's so worth it when you get there because there's no electricity, and they use only solar, and so it's quiet and peaceful. And
sounds like a great place to write a book.
It's a great place. I need to do one on, I think I need to do one on Fanan.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger, roger. What's our vector, Victor?
Now I radio clearance, over.
That's Clarence, over.
Over.
Roger.
Huh?
I remember a good 20 years ago hearing about locations throughout Jordan that attempts were made to preserve them as natural preserves, nature areas untouched by crazy development. And then about 10 or 12 years ago, I actually went to one in Dana, in the reserve there, and they were really trying to figure out a way, way before we came up with the buzzwords of sustainable and the buzzwords of green or carbon footprint. And now I think they've done it. They've come up with something called the Fanan Eco Lodge. And joining me now, the guy who runs it, Nabil Tarazi. Hi, Nabil.
Hi, Peter.
I mean, bottom line is, you heard the terms I used.
Yes, yes, I have, of course.
Which are often misleading. People tend to define them in ways that only benefit them and as opposed to the bigger picture. So define for me, if you can, what your Eco Lodge is doing that that other people aren't.
I'll tell you what's unique about what we have. We have a lodge, which is a hotel in the middle of nowhere in a nature reserve called Dana, and it has an ethos that is very unique, different from anywhere else. And the ethos stands on four pillars. The first one is to offer guests unique and authentic experiences tied to nature, the history, the environment that we are in. The second one is to contribute to conservation work. The third one is to benefit the local community, and the fourth to do it all with a minimal impact on the environment.
Well, you said the third one, which is always gets my attention, the benefit of the local community, because yes. So many places will tell you they're doing a great job, but the money never gets back to the people who need it the most.
At Fanan, it's very different. 55% actually of what the guest pays stays in the immediate local community. I'm not talking about in Jordan, I'm talking about the community of Fanan. Basically, all the employees are local staff. All the services that we get come from the local community. We have women that break bread out of their own goat hair tents that serve the lodge. We do experiences to take the guests to the home of the local communities. And they're effectively goat hair tents. And we do experiences there, how to make bread, how to do the coffee, how to do the makeup, all these things. And all the benefit that we collect from the guests goes to the community member who's providing that experience.
So they can easily connect the dots and follow the money.
Yes, very true. I mean, at the lodge, we have 80 families, around 400 people that benefit directly from the existence of that lodge in this location.
Wow. And how long did it take you to put this together?
We did not do it ourselves. The lodge was done by an NGO in Jordan called the Royal Society for the Conservation of Nature. Jordan is very unique in the sense that it's a conservation organization that handles all the nature reserves. They built the lodge in 2005. The company that I operate, Eco Hotels, we took over the management in 2009, and we turned it from a property that was a very environmentally friendly property to a destination. We created awareness. We created the experiences that are offered by the place. We made it much more green than before and became a destination for people who want something very unique and different in Jordan.
And what can I do there that I can't do anywhere else?
It's the whole experience at Fanan has a lot for everybody. It starts from arriving at the lodge. You arrive at the lodge during daytime. You see this unique building in the middle of nowhere, literally in the middle of
nowhere.
Now,
when you say it's the middle of nowhere, give me a sense of place. We're in Amman, so how long does it take us to get there?
2.5 hours by
on,
road.
On rugged road.
No, no, 2.5 hours
on regular road. And then
the last half an hour is off-road.
It's sheer terror.
It's not terror. It's an off-road to get to the lodge so that it's very remote. And the beauty about it, we have a sunset hike, spectacular sunset hike overlooking Wadi Araba, which is in the south of Jordan. We have stargazing. The lodge is totally off the grid. We generate our electricity using the sun. So we only have electricity lights in the bathrooms. Aside from that, it's all candlelit. So you go on the rooftop terrace after dinner, and you have a spectacular sky with no artificial light pollution around you. The next day, there are lots of experiences that you can do, from hikes to experiences with the local community to doing a cooking class at the lodge, or getting the chef of the lodge do a cooking demonstration, show you how to cook things. So it's a very different experiences that you can do, or you can just go and sit and chill out, relax. You're literally in the middle of nowhere,
and
quiet.
But there's wildlife.
There is limited wildlife. Part of the problem with Jordan is the NGO that I was talking about, the Royal Society for the Conservation of Nature, was started by ex-hunters. They found out that they hunted most of what existed in Jordan.
Whoops.
So they started conserving. So the reserve where we are, you might be able to see ibex.
I've seen the ibex, yeah.
So you will see these things, but it's not this massive wildlife that you would get in Africa. That's the problem that we have in Jordan. But the NGO is restoring and bringing back, reintroducing some of the wildlife that existed in the reserve. So it's a continuing process.
Great. And if you can survive the last half hour on the road, then you get to chill out.
Yeah, the half hour is not bad, actually. You know, it's a fun ride. We use the local community to provide the shuttle service to benefit the local community. So you're in this beat-up pickup. Most of the guests decide not to sit inside the pickup. They will go in the back because it's very fun.
They stand up,
sit down, whatever they want.
And hold on.
Yeah, you hold on. But it's not too bad. It's not as bad as you make it sound to be.
It's an adventure.
It is an adventure.
Okay, you agree with that?
I agree with you 100%.
Okay, good.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
In this election year, all eyes are glued to the television sets, in America at least, to watch the circus known as our presidential campaign. Saturday Night Live wakes up every morning, the cast, thanking the candidates for giving them such material that they could never get on their own. Every comedian is just falling over laughing, as we are as well. And it's also quite disturbing, too. And all that humor comes out of a lot of angst and stress and basically depression. But being that as it may, here we are in Jordan, and there's comedy here too.
Yeah, hopefully.
There's comedy here too. In fact, the Arab world's first ever comedy in both English and Arabic.
Yeah.
Political satire, right?
Exactly. It's social and political, yeah.
And like the person on that other end of the microphone is Faris Haradine, who's the co-star of a show called My American Neighbor.
Yes.
Tell me the premise.
Okay, the premise is this. We have this wonderful American guy. His name is Brett Weir. He lived in Jordan since 2007. And he loved the country. And we became really good friends through comedy, along with another guy. Now, what's really unique about this this relationship is that I'm a Jordanian Catholic, and he's an American Protestant. And the third guy is the Muslim guy, our friend Nadir Khawalde. So actually, religion has its toll in this region. And it's really unique how we were able to deliver a message of peacemaking and how reconciliation and throughout the whole project. Yeah, and what else? I'm really excited to be here, and I'm honored to meet you personally.
Oh, and vice versa. What's interesting though is you wouldn't think in certain countries that political satire would not have consequences.
You
make fun of certain governments in certain countries, you're not on the air very long.
That's really true. But really, the atmosphere here, the whole theme started like more than 15 years ago. And that was by the two guys. One guy, his name is Nabil Sawalha, and the other guy, his name is Hisham Yanis. Both, they established this type of art, satire, where they'll be impersonating different political figures. Okay. Now, speaking about my American neighbor, the whole idea is that Brett was living between. Arab friends, and it was the comedy will be from the cultural differences. For example, if you're in Jordan and someone tells you that's a nice watch, okay, the first thing you say to him, mgeddeme, which means you can take it, okay, but that's actually not really a genuine you can take it. It's just like it's a social thing. But in the series, we see that Abu Trad. I'm playing Abu Trad. He's a guy, he's a bit grumpy, and he's in his late 40s, early 50s. So when he said, you can take it, and then Ricky, who is Brett Weir, the American guy, he said, oh, really? Thank you. And then he takes the watch. And here the conflict starts, you know what I mean? And we have a lot of stuff that goes in between this family.
But the comedy is about local Jordanian politics, too.
It has some implications. Like, for example, Abu Trad will show that part in the Arab world where he's... a lot of Jordanians, some they believe that they have some hostile emotions towards the states, and that's because of the foreign policy, etc. And he will speak that in the show, but in a funny way, because at the end of the day, we will see that they get along a lot, and they're all the time they're together.
And what about the royal family? Can you talk about them at all?
To be honest,
no.
No, we don't.
Not a good idea.
It's not the best idea, but well, it depends how, because the late play which I participated in was Sarha Rab Raiha, and actually there's a guy who impersonated the king. So he was,
and he's still alive.
He's still alive.
Oh, okay, just double checking.
Yeah, he's
the
still
the name
alive.
Of your show, though, is My American Neighbor. It's both in Arabic and English.
And English, yeah.
That's very, very cool. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.